This is the Race Like a Girl podcast, where you always get a one-of-a-kind RC talk experience from the female perspective. Our motto is to always strive to beat the guys. So without further ado, here are your fuel-burning, four-wheel drive-turning hosts, Katie and Mackenzie.
Everyone, welcome to the next episode of Race Like a Girl. I know it's been a while since we've got a chance to release some content to you guys, but I'm super excited to get a Southern Nats episode out, and we specifically have a special guest with Lance on the podcast. So, hey, Lance, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Katie, thank you for having me.
So I feel like I really don't need to introduce you because I feel like everybody in the RC community knows you at this point, but we're still going to go backwards a little bit since we've never had you on our podcast before. So kind of just start with who you are and how the heck you got into this RC world.
Okay. Lance McDonald, race announcer director now for probably going on 7 years, maybe a little more, not very long. Got into RC back in 2010 with my son, who at the time was probably right around about 11 years old, 10 years old, somewhere right around there. We were driving past a Hobbytown USA, and they were having their RC Olympics outside. Caught our eye, stopped in, and right there we bought a Team Associated ready to run short course truck, Traxxas ready to run monster truck. And from that point forward, we were hooked. Several thousands of dollars later, we were full bore into it.
That's awesome. So I know your son is in college now, right?
He did 2 years at a university, playing football, and it got to the point to where his body was hurting him a little bit. College football's a little rougher than high school football, and he decided to end it at 2 years, and now works for Publix and lives in Lakeland, about 3 hours away from where his mom and I live.
So do y'all still get to go racing anymore together?
No, Peyton hasn't raced. He got really big into football and weightlifting. His junior year, things started developing for him in a sophomore, but his strength program and ability really changed drastically in his junior year, and it exploded in his senior year. So his senior year, basically he was kind of done racing, because he was so focused on the next step in his life with football and college and things like that. He hasn't held a remote now in a great number of years. I think last time he might have held a remote was back maybe 2018, maybe. It's been a while since he's touched one. I think he would like to do it again, but Dad's not going to fund it. So it's kind of going to be up to him if he wants to get into it. I'll help out a little bit, but Dad's not going to fund it like he used to.
That's kind of the beauty of RC racing, though, is that it really doesn't matter what age you are or when you get out of it or back into it, if he does decide to get back into it, because you can RC car race at any age. So, yeah, maybe we'll see him back at the track one day.
Yeah, I imagine one day you'll see him back.
So you are actively involved in the RC community, especially as of recently. So what keeps you in the RC community, especially active in the race announcing scene?
Really, it is the only reason why I kind of got back into it. I quit the big stuff in 2018. I got way too involved in too much what's going on in Florida, in the Southeast, on the East Coast. and I had to take a huge step back. So I stopped for almost 2 years, just did very little small events here and there. But whenever I came, essentially quotation mark, came back, people were really, really calling me regularly to come announce, come do this, come back, you know, kind of thing. And a lot of people, you know, told me, and I seen there were some gaps, some things that were missing, some things that were kind of, you know, going downhill a little bit. And so I talked to my wife about it, and I talked to other people about it, and I was like, well, I'll come back under these circumstances. I'm not getting as involved into it as I did back in 2018. I was doing, you know, 2017, of the 52 weekends, I had 44 events in 17. And then 18, I did 30 something of 52 weekends. So it was every weekend going from track to track to track. And it was wearing on me big time. And so now when I came back, I'm not doing nowhere near as many events. So it's a lot easier on me. I'm not any younger either. Getting old.
Well, we're definitely happy to have you back, but I'm going to back up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're interviewing you right now because you were the announcer at the Southern Nats, and actually you were at Wicked Weekend too, which we were there as well. But how did you get into the announcing side of things? And how do you feel like, especially all the way up until you quit in 2018, how do you feel like your job as a race announcer essentially really got as big as it did?
So the way I got started in announcing was Super Cup, J Concept Super Cup, January of 2013, I believe is what it was, maybe 14. It was a banquet weekend, and we if I remember correctly, we practiced on Saturday and we raced on Sunday. Everybody was having a real good time at the banquet. Some had too much of a good time. You know, they enjoyed themselves, which they had every right to do. And they were running a little bit behind on getting started the next day. There was a gentleman there that was doing race registrations and trying to kind of handle it all by himself. And I was like, look, I got to go help this guy. You know, he's there's 300 entries here for a single day event on a Sunday. We're 30 minutes already past from when we were supposed to start, if I remember right. And we hadn't even put all the entries in the computer yet. So I just went over and just started helping. I really didn't know what I was doing. I just started helping. And I started helping, you know, tag team the announcing part of it a little bit. For some reason, I just had a little bit of a knack in calling the race. And that's where it all really kind of started at. I was announcing a little bit at our local track, which was Shiverville, which unfortunately is no longer around. But what really kicked it all off was Super Cup, and I believe it was 2014. It might have been 2013, but I think it was 2014 is when it really started. I did that for a little while, kind of started videos. I don't know if you remember Periscope or not. There were some people doing some live video through Periscope, and it started kind of, word started kind of spreading a little bit about enthusiasm and the way I announced. Then I got a call from Bubba Barham at Flowood, Mississippi, and asked me to come do an event there. And that was really kind of my first, what I would call, gig or big job that I did. Super nervous, still wasn't very experienced. I remember even setting up the races. I set the race order up completely wrong. I was running Nitro and Electric Pros back-to-back and things like that, you know. But anyway, some guys with more experience, you know, kind of walked me through it, and we got it all taken care of. And then I think that following year, that following April or March, I got a call from Dave Lycom to come up. And this was the last year that they were at the place in Georgia, Southeastern Arena, where they had PNB at for a great number of years, to come up and help out. And I did. And the rest from there was history. From that point on, I was hired on from with Racetime and stayed with them for a great number of years until I took a break, took my hiatus.
Aside from Racetime, though, I mean, y'all had the Florida series, and then you all housed, I didn't get to go to that Nationals, but you all housed an amazing Fuel Nationals. Mm-hmm. So just take us through some of those things.
Yeah, Fuel Nats was probably the hardest event that I've ever done, ever. Mostly because it's your track crew, you know. There was so much going on. I was trying to help Roar as much as I could. It was too much, actually. It took me several weeks to recover. It wasn't just me. It was all of us. It was so hot. It was rainy, so many people. We had so much stuff going on between, we had that big Jumbotron, and we were trying to work with that big tarp system that the guys had engineered and developed, which worked wonderful, by the way. We still get compliments on that tarp system that we developed and made work for Nashville, because it's in June. We know it's going to rain. So that was really kind of the cream on the cake, or the topping on the cake there, that really, I'm not going to say it broke me, but it took me months to recover from that physically and mentally. I was completely and totally drained after that one. There's a lot that goes on with Nationals that people don't know about. The tracks that put those on do. And there are reasons why you typically don't see Nationals go back to a lot of tracks, because of the huge financial investment, the small amount of financial return. But it's a lot of work. It's hard when you got regular jobs.
So I'm going to stay on Nationals since we're there and talking about it. How do you feel? I mean, you were in the trenches, as one would say, with that event. How would you say that there can be improvement to specifically the Fuel Nationals event?
That's a loaded question there. So for Nationals, there are a great deal of number of things that needs to take place. There needs to be more. Your premier event that you put on needs to have all aspects of all people involved very knowledgeable on one how to hold and race an event. There needs to be more personnel that are dedicated to the event. As far as Roar, in my opinion, does not come with enough people. They should, for the amount of money that they're bringing in for the Roar Fuel Nats, they should come with more bodies. They should come with a group of, you know, 6 to 8 instead of 4. There just aren't enough bodies. And to ask tracks to, because right now they ask for tracks for volunteers. When you have volunteers that get beat down physically and mentally at those events prior, and during, trying to manage parking and people and bathrooms and cleaning up and just all these different aspects of it, you're expecting too much of those people. It's not like they're paying them tracks, you know, a tremendous amount of money. They're bringing in a lot of money for Fuel Nats. Fuel Nats and Electric Nats, as far as 8-scale off-road, need to be combined. It's supposed to have, or expect companies to turn right back around a month later and travel again, when they could just turn this into an actual week-long event and run the Electric Nats and the Fuel Nats together and just be the 8-scale off-road. It would be a lot better for everyone, in my opinion. It would also be a lot better if they were to work with facilities or tracks or even race promoter like Racetime Entertainment or Joey with Silver State or something along those lines, and start making these events premier events and having them indoor facilities. You know, it's you can't have your premier event scheduled in the middle of June and run it in Florida or anywhere in the South. It's going to rain no matter what. Choose better locations, have them indoors. It's your premier event. You only run it once a year. You know, do it the right way. Get the personnel that is extremely knowledgeable on how to handle events. The rules aspect of it. There are parts and times when I don't know what the thoughts are on the rules. I mean, they're cut and dry, and they make different decisions at races and stuff. I don't get it. Too many mistakes, too many problems, you know, for something that's only held once a year. You got a whole year to prepare. And they just have their issues. So anyway, about the best I can do on that one.
No, I love hearing your thoughts on that, especially coming from a person who has been in the thick of it. It's easy for an outsider who hasn't been that heavily involved in it to say, you know, like, oh, this sucks and that sucks. Mm-hmm. But being a person in the trenches, like, what can we actually do, control, and fix, or at least have a conversation about to try to make better? The Fuel Nats especially, though, Nitro, still gets a crazy amount of entries and is really a pinnacle event. Why do you feel like that is, even with all the cracks or things that we talk about can be improved?
Yeah, 8-scale Nitro Racing is the premier class. When you compare it to 10th scale, it just doesn't have that draw. People will definitely tune in for the 10th scale on the modified side to watch people battle because they know they're going to be good races. But the 8 scale side of it, I think it's because everybody kind of is a little bit more on an open playing field when it comes to chassis. There's so many variables when it comes to 10th scale, especially now that it's kind of going into such a high bite tailored groove. You know, a lot of people, they forget when you're dealing with super, super high bike track where you're running a ghosted tire or a slick tire or even on a carpet surface, your margin of error becomes extremely small. The faster the cars go, the smaller the margin of error. And people get frustrated. I think on the 8 scale side of it, you don't see as much super high bite. You have a little bit more of the fluff to work with, grooves a little bit wider. It gives people options for different skill levels, where in the 10th scale side on the high bite of it, if you're not 100% on every corner, you break just a tenth of a second late or accelerate a little bit too quickly. You know, it costs you serious time, and it's hard to recoup because either you're racing for 5 minutes, 6 minutes, or at max, you know, 10 minutes. It's hard to recover from a bobble that you have to be marshaled.
We used to race 10 scale a lot, but the indoor track that we had closest to us closed down. And so for that reason alone, we don't race 10 scale as much anymore. But once I didn't have 10 scale anymore, and the closest track to me is BeachRC, which I love BeachRC, but it's like a 4-hour drive to BeachRC. It was like all Nitro from then on out. But, you know, just with some 10th scale tracks closing, I mean, there's a lot of people in the same boat, and it just seems like 8th scale has really grown, especially for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Like 10th scale started dying down about 2017. You really seen short course, two-wheel drive and four-wheel drive really starting to kind of die off. And it as a whole has really, on the 10th scale side, died. But now you have your premier events. You know, you have your Masters of Dirt. You have your Reedy, which I hope they're going to get to race Reedy this year. I haven't. It's you know, middle of September. I haven't seen any announcements about Reedy yet or where it's going to move to. I don't know if OCRC is going to be, how much longer they're going to be around. I heard that they're supposed to be closing by the end of the year, but I don't know how much truth there is to that or official announcement, unless I missed something. Then you have Florida Carpet Champs, which is coming up in a little over a month and a half, 2 months away. Those are really big tent scale races. But, I mean, even look at tent scale nationals this year. There was, 160 entries, 170 entries, where, Fuel Nats is 350. You know, that race sells out in minutes whenever registration opens. And there's no slowing on that side of it down. I'd expect it again this year to completely and totally sell out.
It is crazy. It's stressful not being a pro and being a person who can get immediately into the Fuel Nationals. And especially with us trying to get two of us in there, it's like, oh my gosh, if Dave got in and I didn't, or if I got in and Dave didn't, we would have some problems in our household. Because I'm sure it wouldn't be easy for the other person who was in to just be like, oh, yeah, I guess I just won't do the Fuel Nat since you didn't get in. So, yes, it's a very stressful time as a racer trying to get into that. I mean, I guess we can talk for a second. What are your thoughts on that being the way that people sign up or get into that race? I know the pros, I think it works, especially if they were in a certain level of heat.
Yeah. Everybody that makes the semifinals, I think, are automatically locked in for next year.
Right. So they don't necessarily have to worry about it. But what are your thoughts, I guess, on it just being that way where it's the fastest click on the computer for the rest of the guys getting into that race?
Yeah. And it shouldn't be that way. This is back where on the regional level that there really should be regional qualifiers or have super regionals where you have qualifiers that will get you into nationals. That's where there's a big problem. It shouldn't come down to who's fastest on it. So you lock your better regional or super regional racers in that are going, and then you fill heats from there. It is really the way it should be done. It doesn't need to be done by the fastest click. It should be a lottery system, similar to the way Reedy does it. Should be very open and transparent on when it's done. You know, they could really hype things up on, they could do pick an evening out of it, do it live, for a lottery style. And fill the final, say, 100 or 150 or whatever it is, positions. The fastest click on it is not the way to do it on that aspect. It's the only bad thing about having capped races is that even in my series is capped as well, and there's people that want to race that don't make it. And I feel bad, and I want them to race. I would love for them to race, but at the same time, in the time aspect of it, you have to be firm and as fair as you can. But as nationals go, it really needs to be on a lottery system and using a regional or super regional qualifier.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but if we didn't make it in regionally, man, that'd be hard being in a lottery system as well. But I completely agree with your thoughts. Yeah. So I'm going to move on from nationals for a second, but I'm going to be honest with you. After 2018, and you said that you were done announcing, I never thought I'd see you at a Racetime Entertainment event again. So how did it happen that you are now the announcer for all of the Racetime Entertainment events this year? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so I started my series back up. I started a series back up here in Florida. Like I said, I was getting a lot of calls, texts, requests to come back. So I thought about it, and did. And when I held, see, I want to say when I held my first race in February, you know, David reached out to me and wanted to know if I wanted to come back. You know, he, I, and Bobby had some discussions and cleared some air on a lot of things, and apologies were made and accepted, and, you know, there was a lot of deep scars and hurt there from a lot of different things on both sides. And finally, we all put our big boy pants on and straightened it all out. And I was back at P&B in April.
I've already said that it was super nice to have you back. I always enjoy you as the race announcer. I mean, there's a reason that everyone calls you and wants to hire you for these events, because you're extremely good at what you do. And now that we've taken the listeners all the way through your career up until present day, that's kind of what I want to get into next. Is I'm going to stick with race directing here. And what specifically, in your opinion, is needed for a good race director, or is like things that good race directors should do when they're directing any race, not even necessarily the big, huge race time entertainment events like you just did this past weekend?
Yeah, the number one thing is, well, let me tell you, there's two very important things. The number one thing is clearly time management, whether it be a local race, club race, a regional, anything, or a big event, right, like a Race Time or Nationals. It is all about time management. People don't realize how much 5 seconds a race, 10 seconds a race can cost you in adding up. The second thing is, you've got to give the racers the information that they need. They really want to know what position they are on the track and how far away they are from the person in front of them and how far away the person is behind them, because they will change their demeanor on the way they drive, whether they drive defensively or aggressively to make up time. Those are always the two things that I hear a lot of racers always talk about is, well, I didn't know where I was, or you know, I didn't know how far away or how close or da, 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 da. Now, whenever I announce, whenever I do qualifying, I try to keep track of everybody on the track and let them know when I see battles are getting kind of close. You know, you're X amount of seconds away from this spot or the lead or TQ. Now, whenever I get to the mains, that changes. I'll probably typically would just call just a running order and really focus on where the close battles are on the track. If it is a battle for the lead for 10 minutes, that's what I'm going to talk about 90% of the time. Because I'm trying to announce the highest running battle on the track, you know, to make it as interesting as possible. And that's for every main. If somebody's in a D main, the guy that's winning the D main or running third for the bump up in D main is working just as hard as the guy that's winning the A main. He is driving to the maximum of his ability, giving it everything he's got for that spot. So he deserves just as much enthusiasm as the race win. That's the reason why I usually, when we get to the A main, my voice is usually shot, typically.
We weren't able to go to the Southern Nat simply because it's pretty far for us, and we just don't have days left between all the days we took off for Nationals especially. But not that I didn't want to go, but we watched it all, the mains especially. We had it on the TV the entire day, and we could definitely tell by the e-buggy races at the end that your voice was all but gone. But yeah. And we're definitely going to get into this, but I mean, rightfully so, because man, were there some amazing battles and races in every class, not even just the pro premier classes. But I think that's important for racers to understand that perspective too, because I feel like racers can be very critical of any announcer, not just speaking for you of what is actually announced when a race is going on. So I guess what is the thing that annoys you the most about a racer comment about the announcing that you've done?
Well, you know, things that I always get beat on about is, and it's not just me, it's a lot of them, not calling, rough driving, different things like that. It's something I always get beat on about. Well, earlier in when I started racing, I tried calling rough driving, and it was always, well, I guess you didn't see the corner before when he blew me up. You know, I heard that. Or, you know, I didn't blow him up, he stopped in front of me. Or, I can't believe you let that guy just drive right straight through me, but you just bounced off the pipe 2 seconds earlier and you were going slow, kind of thing. There are so many aspects of it that whenever an incident occurs on the track, it is the race director's fault for not nannying the situation. Are there times when legitimate penalties need to be issued? Absolutely, 100%. But I'm not there to nanny it to that aspect. And this is me personally. Racing is going to have incidents. It's going to happen. And to penalize things constantly and every little thing, I don't want people out there thinking like, oh, Lord, I got to follow this guy. I'm scared to pass him because if I touch him, even if it's not my fault, I'm going to get a penalty. That takes the excitement out of the racing. I don't want that to be in their head to stop them from making or trying a legitimate pass. You know, I shouldn't have to hamstring people that way. Sportsmanship is, it needs to be handled by the racer, not by the race director, in my opinion. There are a lot of people that will disagree with that, but at the same time, I don't have an instant replay. We will never have instant replay to make calls because there's only one race director on the stand, and he can't take his eyes off of a screen to watch another screen for a minute to figure out what exactly happened while there's racing still going on the track. Even if you hire multiple people to handle the situation, now you got to have a referee guy in there watching video. So realistically, in our sport, you're never going to have instant replay. So I have to make decisions based upon what happened within milliseconds. And I'm sure you're going to ask me about what my thoughts were with Mayfield and Fuller. Did I make the right call because I didn't make a call? Absolutely. I watched him, and you can even listen back on the video. Mayfield slowed down considerably in the corner. Now, was Fuller 100% going for it? You bet your buddy was, and I don't blame him one bit. I'd have went for it too, and everybody knows Mayfield would have went for it as well. Mayfield would checked up because there was a hole or a blowout that was opened up right in that corner. It was a very small, narrow spot where there was good track, and then there was that blowout. So he had checked up a little bit too much. Mason wasn't. Mason come in through that corner, and he was tight on the pipe, and he had the line. He took the line away from Ryan. I'll tell everybody up front, I am a huge Ryan Mayfield fan. I didn't want to see him lose a race. I wanted him to win after what happened in his truggy with the motor issues. And yeah, I really wanted to see him on the podium. But that day, it was 100% Mason Fuller, and I was very proud of what he did. Kid went for it, biggest win of his life. He'll remember this the rest of his life, for sure. So that's my biggest kind of pet peeve. Everybody expects the race director to do something about every little incident on the track. Well, did the guy check up in front of you, or did you come in just a little too odd into the corner? You know, I can't make those decisions off of that in milliseconds. It's too much, too hard.
You definitely got into a lot of questions that I had, but I also feel like you're exactly right. Without instant replay, it's very hard to even determine who is at fault. my own personal racing style is, I mean, really no secret. If you've watched me race, I'm a bit more timid, less wide open than especially my husband is, if I compare myself to my husband. And a lot of conversations, we'll call them, that I've had with racers where we've disagreed about a racing incident that has happened is I oftentimes felt like, you know, I was the one getting run over, because at that point in the race, regardless of if so-and-so was faster than me or not, I had the position on you. It's not like I had to let you go because I was going a lap down to you. But to their point, to their side, oftentimes they would communicate with me, well, you overslowed that corner. So that's not my problem that you overslowed my corner and or your corner. And I guess what I'm trying to say there is there's two sides to every story, regardless of who gets wrecked. So in the moment of racing, it's almost impossible to come to a conclusion regardless of whose responsibility is. Like, that just has to be, I don't know, almost it's part of racing sort of thing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah.
But that was actually one of my follow-up questions, is whose responsibility do you think it is, if anyone's, to determine that? And, you know, especially, do you feel like it's even the race director's responsibility? Because a lot of people put it on the race director to have that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'll bring up an instance that I did not see because I was looking at the computer screen, and it was from this weekend. And it was a nitro buggy whenever Mayfield and Finn got together. So I seen Finn come through that double and got into the side of Mayfield. What I didn't know was right as that was happening after that double, I didn't realize that Mayfield had overshot the double, had got into the dust, was outside of the racing line, and was going extremely slow. Well, I guess I shouldn't say extremely slow. He was not carrying the speed that he was the lap prior, or the speed that Finn was carrying. We all know that as we're looking at our cars, we're trying to look ahead as much as we can. But if that guy slows up 20%, 30%, there's no way as a racer we know. And then we're going to run into the back of him or into the side of him or something along those lines. But people will expect me, the race director, to make a call on that. Well, no, I'm not, because I don't know what happened beforehand. So I just don't make calls anymore, excuse me, that's related to incidences on the track, unless it's blatant, very, very blatant.
You mentioned that there, in your previous answer, you mentioned that there were times where penalties needed to be administered. What do you feel like is the level that qualifies for a penalty? And also, what's the hardest call you've ever had to make?
I think that whenever you're working down straights, it amazes me how little people can hold their line in a straight. You know, I've seen people just run wide down a straightaway to deliberately hit people because they're outside of the line that they wanted to be in for the next corner. I've seen that happen before. Those are times when I think penalties really should be issued. My hardest call that I've ever had to make, I'm trying to honestly think of something in the top of my head, because for so long I have gotten to where I don't make on race incident calls. I was pretty hard on my own kid several times. I was very hard on him, actually, several times. Those are tough ones. I got accused of favoritism a lot, but I was super, super hard on him, you know, about things. He was very, very aggressive racer. We have racers that every lap is their last lap for the win. And then we have some racers that methodically think things through and will work their way through tracks or through races. We're all just different breeds of racer. But as far as the hardest call I've ever had to make, I can't think of one that just automatically stands out right away in my head on the track. I don't think I've ever disqualified anybody for an on-track incident as far as contact. I've had to ask people to leave for behavior, but not for on-track incident.
You actually touched on something twice that I wanted to ask about. So you mentioned that, you know, it's no secret. You'll tell everyone that Ryan Mayfield is one of your favorite drivers. And then you mm-hmm. also spoke about how you were announcing when your son was driving. I feel like, you know, I've never announced necessarily, but when I watch races, if there's a girl in the race, for one, I'm probably for sure going to cheer for the girl over other racers. I mean, that's not a secret. I get excited when any females of our gender can show up the guys and mm-hmm. you know, actually compete with the males. But I mean, there's other people, whether it's the pro class or not, that when I watch, I feel like I show favoritism when I'm watching them. And my husband is a perfect example. If I am marshalling, especially when he's racing, that is like the most awful mix. And I am a big component of, you know, watching my corner and not watching the race sort of thing. But man, is it difficult when my husband is on the track. I pretty yeah. much have to have a constant conversation with myself in my head, tell myself to watch my corner and remind myself of that every time he's on the track and I'm trying to marshal. But anyways, mm-hmm. I say all that to ask, like, I feel like if I were announcing my husband's race, it would be hard for me not to fluctuate voice or show favoritism when trying to call that race. So people who are your favorites, like someone like Ryan Mayfield or your son, or even I'd imagine when you go to these big races, like a Racetime Entertainment event, and there's some of your Florida guys there, I imagine there's that same kind of relationship with them as well versus other people who you might not know as well. So do you ever find it difficult when you're announcing to kind of like keep that same straight fluctuation or enthusiasm for any racer, regardless of, you know, like who they are or how they're related to you?
Yeah, it does get, it's hard. I'm human. You know, I'm an emotional person as far as I love the highs of the event where I hate the lows of the event. You know, there is no secret. There are drivers that don't like me. There are drivers that I don't care for either. But they're still out there competing on a level that I need to announce for them the same that I do for the others. Do I get more excited on others than I do some? Yes, let's say I like this past weekend, you had Drew Spurgeon. Absolutely dominated the 40-plus nitro buggy. Just killed everybody in 40-plus nitro buggy. But he was the dead last qualifier in 40-plus e-buggy. He just had nothing but bad luck. Didn't even show up for his third qualifier. He's like, I give up. I could see it all over his face. He's like, I'm not coming back to run this thing again today. And then he showed back up on main day and started dead last in the C main, drove all the way up through to the A main and won it. That is exciting. That is something to really focus on. When drivers bump up from a lower main and they are knocking on the door of a win or made up half of the field, that's something to be excited about of the next main. I'm a Born Horse fan. I really like watching Joe race. To be honest with you, he's kind of like my Joe. I'm not saying Joe's never won anything big because he has, but he hasn't won a national title on the fuel side. You know, he still hasn't broke, you know, top five echelon of it's always going to be competing for the top spot. And I hope, I pray that I'm the day that I'm announcing that Joe wins a Nitro Buggy at a race time event or nationals or whatever it may be. I just hope I'm there. I want to see it happen. I really want to see him do well. You know, Ryan Lutz is a really good guy. You know, I would love to see him do well, you know, before his career starts kind of winding down. You know, they're up and comers. Brandon Rose, I'd love to see him, you know, hit that podium. It'd be a big win for him, just like it was for Mason Fuller. When David Olson won Truggy this weekend, I was so happy for him. You know, it's his first major win. It is hard to keep the same level of enthusiasm for every single racer, every single race. One, it's physically, it gets to be demanding physically. But it is something that is very, very difficult to do when you have racers, because I'm a race fan. You know, I want to see the people that I cheer for, that I pull for, do well. I don't want to see anybody, regardless of what personal feelings are, I don't want to see anybody taken out of a race. I don't want to see anybody fall out of a race, because on the pro level side, this is their livelihood. You know, I want to see them all succeed. But at the same time, you know, of course, I want to see my racers succeed. You know, I want to see the ones I pull for, the ones I cheer for. You know, when I watch, when I'm a spectator and I'm just watching, those are the ones I want to see. The same way on the NASCAR side or on the IndyCar side. I just have people that I cheer for. I want to see them do good. You know, it just means more to me personally.
Yeah, I guess that's why I asked it, because, I mean, I watch a NASCAR race and it's no secret. I've probably said it on the podcast before that I'm going to cheer for Kyle Busch because I love him and he's my favorite driver. And I don't necessarily mean to get into that, but I feel like there can be that same thing in RC racing if we could get it to that next level. Because just as it is fun for someone to sit at home and cheer for Kyle Busch in NASCAR or Newgarden in IndyCar, I feel like there can be that excitement for someone sitting at home if they knew who our pro drivers in this sport was, like they know about NASCAR or IndyCar. But neither here nor there. I could see it being difficult for me being in, you know, your shoes, trying to keep that same level of excitement and tone for every single racer. I don't remember what race it was because we watched quite a bit of them, but there was one race you spoke to, like it's really exciting when someone bumps from a lower main and then does good in the next main. There was one race where car 2, 3, and 4 that finished that race. Now, granted, car 4 doesn't bump. Only 1, 2, and 3 bumped at the Southern Nats. But car 2, 3, and 4 were 16, 17, and 18. So what that meant was the three guys that bumped for the previous from the previous main were now the 2, 3, and 4 finishing car in the next main. I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, it's impressive when one guy does that. And now two out of the bump guys just did it. And the third guy was super close at being right there with him. So I don't remember what class that was, but that was crazy just to see the 2, 3, 4 be the 16, 17, and 18 car. And I guess since we're talking about that, I'm going to go ahead and put a plug in for my homegirl, Kayla, because she started at the back of the B main in intermediate E buggy, and she went and won the darn thing. And, you know, no mistake there. There were some fast racers with Morant and everyone else who was in that class. So kudos to Kayla for doing that similar thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree 100% there. That that drive that Kayla had in that A main was impressive. Very, very impressive. She did it the hard way. It wasn't by pure luck that she just, you know, rough start from everybody else and picked up, you know, 12 positions right on the first lap. She had to drive through the field to get up there. and she did. She did really, really good. I was really, really happy for her.
So the whole reason that we even have you on this podcast today is because there was a comment made on one of your Facebook posts. You posted and said, like, you know, it was a great weekend at Southern Nats. I have so many stories for you guys, but, like, I'm tired. So to be continued sort of thing. And someone was like, man, you should do a podcast. I don't even remember who it was, but you tagged me and Keenan and were like, yeah, leave it up to them to do the podcast. And so that's how it all started. And that's how we got you on the podcast. So basically what I'm asking is, we want to hear the stories, man. What are the stories that you have to tell?
So this is, I have run numerous indoor races, numerous. This is the second one that it rained indoors. I have never seen so much water dripping off of a roof in my life as I did at this place. It was insane, especially down in the mezzanine area where all the guys were pitting at. When I tell you the floor was mud, it was mud. I'm not joking. It was a mess. Apparently for years, they have fans up top, but the majority of them didn't work. So this year they all worked and they turned them all on. And it pulled a lot of the fumes and stuff out. I mean, it was quite clear on Friday. But at the same time, it was super humid outside. So it was pulling in all of that hot air with the air conditioner on. And it was raining inside the building. Everything you touch had like this humid layer of water on it. It was a mess. There was a gentleman there, and I still don't know his name. He was in the Mugen pits. He was definitely 100% from Louisiana because he had a very strong Cajun accent. I've never had real Cajun jambalaya in my life. Oh, my God. It was so good. So good. I actually seen him later on. And he asked me how I was like, dude, that's probably one of the best meals I ever ate. I was like, I'd give anything to have another bowl. And just by luck, he still had some left. And he cooked a whole bunch, like this huge pot for everybody. So I had two bowls of that Cajun jambalaya. And my mouth's watering just thinking about it right now. Oh, it's so good. I will go back next year just to know if that guy is in that jambalaya because it was that good. Watching the kids. So there was Phelong Nguyen and some other kids that were just playing around up in the mezzanine, really, or up in the upper deck, that just brought me back to whenever I was racing with my father at 7, 8, 9 years old and all the kids. We all used to run around and playing around. And it just really brought back some memories. Them kids had a ball. Just an absolute blast. It was really cool to see that because typically in most tracks that I go to, I'm isolated from people. And I don't get to see a lot of that stuff going on. And it felt good to see those friendships that grow at tracks that will never be forgotten. I still remember those days. I'm 45 years old. That happened when I was 8, 9 years old, 33 years ago, 34 years ago. I still remember them today. You know, it was really cool to see that kind of stuff. Other cool things of this facility was probably the best that I have ever been to, other than the moisture issue that happened. You know, nice, cool indoor air conditioning. The main day was amazing. We started controlling the fans a little bit better. Instead of turning them all on, we just turned a few on. Got a little smoky a little bit every now and then, but not terrible bad. But yeah, this was a really, really nice event and met a lot of people that I've never seen before. Just met them online through social media, really got to meet them in person. And it was really cool. Really cool on that aspect.
I've never been to that facility before, but just, you know, social media type things, pictures, videos of people being at the event, it looks like a really awesome facility. So I could definitely see why that's one of your highlights. I love to hear that there's still that sort of like play friendship sort of thing going on, even at a race that one would consider like high stakes, big competition. I feel like even with my own friends, like I'll use Mackenzie, for example, there was at least one race where it's like, girl, I didn't even hang out with you this race because I was in my trailer wrenching the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to hear that that is still going on. It's somewhat a little bit easier when it is a bigger event because you're not constantly on the track or, you know, you feel like you have a second to try to do something. How many entries did there end up being at Southern Nets?
Yeah, it was just over 550. is what it was. I know some of the questions that came up were, I thought this event was supposed to be capped. Well, it was. The event was sold out, and I think we already discussed about how there was a hurricane, you know, 2 weeks prior, and there were a lot of entries that were requested to be refunded. And as much as Dave gets accused of being, you know, just a greedy race promoter, he's not. He gave people their money back that asked for it. At the same time, he had to open registrations back up because you have to cover costs. Did it get out of control? Without a doubt. But in a 2 week time frame to be handing out refunds constantly and continuously, and then people like, hey, can I just sign up at the track? Sure. Yeah, that's no problem. Sure. Just sign up at the track. And then a lot more came than what was to be expected. We still worked through it and got the racing in. We had to, for just to manage the time, instead of getting out of there at 11 o'clock at night, we dropped the A2s just to manage the time a little better for the racers, because so many people had to go home that night.
Yeah, so I feel like 100%, of course, he did the right thing trying to refund the people who went through our recent hurricane, which was a very devastating hurricane. I have a good friend here in North Carolina, but her family's still in New Orleans. And just my experiences with her is like crazy how long they're going to go without their houses or without power even. So absolutely understand doing the right thing. I'm just curious though, like what your preference is, because I actually love the idea and have even mentioned this to Scale Racing Sports, who do the like Blue Ridge, you know, Summer Sizzler events at the Apex Center. I love the idea of like not limiting the entries by class, just limiting the entries by number and then filling the heats. Because if I think about something like four-wheel drive short course, say you had that class, I don't even think that class was at Southern Nets, but we're just throwing it out there for a second.
Right.
Say you had a class like four-wheel drive short course, and then you have nitro buggy. Obviously, you may only get one heat of four-wheel drive short course, but you know, you may get 3, 4, 5 heats of nitro buggy, and that's okay that there's an imbalance if you're just restricting the overall number, because that's just general trends of those other classes and how racing goes. So I actually really like and love that idea. But like, what
about like we did at AMS?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But what are your thoughts, I guess, or your preference as a race director? Like, does it make it easier when it's a capped entry like that? I guess, like, what are your thoughts on capped entry versus not capped entry?
Everybody has to understand when you have a non-capped entry race, you have to keep your racing days. You have to try to manage your racing days to roughly right around a 12-hour time frame. You can go a little bit over that, but I have noticed over the years that once you go well over that 12 hours, say you get into the 14-hour time frame, people just start giving up. They start, I'm not racing anymore. I'm quitting. You know, I'll just come back next year. You start seeing a lot more of that. And I'll bring this up, for instance. I don't know if you were watching or not, the Sportsman E-Buggy D-Main. It was getting late in the evening. They ran a little later. There was a 30-minute Nitro A-Main coming up right after them. They were going to have to marshal. The only marshals that came out after their race were the ones really that bumped up. There might have been one or two more, but most every single person left. Well, how do you penalize somebody that's already done racing? You can't. We don't have assigned per marshal position, so I don't know who or wasn't there, but they all left. And I know what their mind thought was. Well, there's 18 of us in this race. There's 13 term marshal spots. They don't need me. I'm going to go ahead and get me an early start home. But the problem was they all did that. And then we didn't have any marshals. That became a little bit of a problem. And again, we were at that. We were getting close to that 12-hour mark. And I don't know what it is. It's something about that 12th hour. People start, I'm going to do this, but then I'm out of here. I've seen it many, many, many times. A capped entry race, one of the best parts about it, my series is capped. I print the heat sheets out a week before the race even starts. Everybody knows what heat they're going to be in, the whole kit and caboodle. That's the beauty of having a capped entry race. You're able to structure things a lot better. You know what race you're going to be up, you know about the times, the whole kit and caboodle. But with a capped entry or uncapped, you don't know until the last entry is in. So it's hard to manage the time. That's when you have to make your decisions. So that's my opinion on that part of it. I like them both. I do like the capped entries more just because we can control, you know, times. We get to see and know where what's going to be what.
I mean, as a racer, I don't know that everybody feels this way, but my personal opinion is I would be willing to pay a little bit more. Maybe not a crazy amount, but I would be willing to pay a little bit more for a capped entry race just to ensure that the times are reasonable, because it's hard to, especially at a big event, it's hard to take off one day of work, let alone two or three, because just the nature of what I do, the thought behind being a teacher is, oh, why do you need a day off? You have the whole summer off. Well, it's like, well, that, yeah, you know, doesn't really fit into my racing schedule. I don't know how else to tell you that. Yeah. But I'd be willing to pay for that experience, I guess, is what I'm saying. Moving into some of the racing, though, what was like, you know, the pro races were obviously exciting because they were the pro races, and we already kind of touched on Mason's pass on Ryan Mayfield in the E-Buggy race specifically. But what are some highlights as far as exciting, like, oh my gosh, this is crazy type races that you announced that weekend?
Yeah, the E-Truggy with David Olson, really, really good. You know, honestly, I thought Tyler Hooks was just going to walk away with it. I really, truly did. That's, he dominated qualifying. But David ran the best race that I've ever seen him drive, and had a perfect setup. Everything, every now and then you get that gold star, and he had it. And it showed in the main when he made that pass on Tyler. It was super clean. Tyler went a little wide in a corner. David seen that opportunity and took big advantage of it, and just never looked back. That was a big win for him. Really happy for him, really proud of him, and his dad. There was a little, and I apologize, I can't remember the young man's name in the, I think it was the Sportsman class. Oh, my mind's drawing a blank. I mean, he might have been 9, 8 years old, maybe 10 at best. One in the Sportsman class. I can't remember his name. I feel bad now. I'm sitting here talking about it. I can't remember the young man's name. That was a big win. You know, I didn't even realize that it was that young of a kid until he was coming down off the driver's stand. I was like, oh my God, that's a little kid. But that was pretty big. Let's see, what else was there? Some of the lower mains were pretty exciting. Joey Bourdon had some good runs. Brandon Rose was really going for it in the B main, winged him in the back, and they both took the bump and the transfer. And Joey had a good main there going for a while also in E main. He was moving up in the field. I thought he even had a chance of getting on the podium. Seth Van Dalen, did you watch any of his B main at all in E buggy?
Yeah, we watched both of them.
Yeah, so he had a break on warm up, and I gave him time to try to get it fixed, but the time was starting to run quite long, and I finally had to move on. And unfortunately, he started a little late. I want to say he probably started about 40 seconds or so late. He was driving forward. If he wouldn't have started late, he would have definitely bumped up because he had the speed. But unfortunately, we were, his minute grace had turned into a lot more than a minute, and I had to get going. So I had to start the race, which stunk. But again, that's just part of racing. I don't know. It's just the ones I can think of off the top of my head there real quick.
When we were watching at one point in the day, we took a break, went and played ping pong, I think is what we were doing. And when we came back into the house, it was still on the TV and you were going crazy in one of the electric races. And I just kind of giggled. I was like, oh man, Lance is back at it again. But that was one of the points where it was sort of later in the main day, especially, and you could tell that your voice was almost losing it. So how do you even manage that? I mean, do you just go for it all the time and hope that your voice makes it till the end?
Yeah, pretty much. It's wing it. I beat up on my voice pretty bad on the weekends at those big events. And obviously, as you can hear a huge difference in my voice, especially in that last main. It was hanging on. There have been times, as a matter of fact, P&B this year, my voice was pretty much gone and it was bleeding. My throat was, like, my vocal cords were bleeding. They were swollen so bad. And there were times I could taste it. And, you know, it's just part of it. The racers are putting on the show. All I'm doing is just telling the story. And, you know, it's exciting. Yeah, I love it. I'm a racer. I've been born and bred into, I started in go-kart racing and then I went stock car racing, and I've done motorcycle racing, and I've done quad racing, and you know, it's just part of it. If there's excitement on the track, I want to announce it. You guys are working for it.
You've been back into drag racing now, haven't you?
I did. I've gotten back into it a little bit, but since I've started announcing again, I don't get to go racing as much as I would like, but it's all good. You know, my time will come. My car's not going anywhere. It's actually sitting outside in the rain right now, which I'm sorry to say and admit, but it is. It's sitting out in the rain right now.
I don't remember if I've talked about it on the podcast or not, to be honest, but for a while, I was pretty heavy into go-kart racing, specifically the LO206 class that they always had at GoPro, which basically just, you know, your Briggs and Stratton sort of lawnmower type motor. Mm-hmm. So not the fastest class that I could have been running, but it was fun nevertheless. And ultimately why we are RC car racing more at this point is Dave was always more than willing to like go to my go-kart race and pit me and work on my go-kart. He runs shifter carts and they never ever had his class at some of the club races that happened more frequently. So that's why he would pit me and not race himself. But ultimately, we are RC car racing more at this point. If not, I don't race my go-kart at all anymore because just the people and the atmosphere at the RC track is totally different. And I don't know, more fun, more friendship, I guess is what I'm trying to say. at the go-kart track, I mean, we're talking like club level race. It's like, it was like, you know, silent in the pits. Like it's to that competitive level where you can't even talk to your competitor because they might see what, you know, you might see what they're doing their cart to their cart to try to improve their cart. And it's just like, oh my gosh, I don't care what you're doing to your cart to gain an extra tenth of a second. I can't even have a conversation with you to try to be friends with my competitors.
Yeah, I raced, that's what I started in, was go-karts in 1984. And I raced all the way up to 1993 before I started racing stock cars. Was successful at it, was one of the very first drivers to actually be sponsored. Bridgestone was a big tire manufacturer back then. It was sponsored by Bridgestone, which I don't even think they're in the go-kart business anymore. I think it's Vega and what's the other brand tire they're running now? I can't even remember the other brand, but I don't even think Bridgestone's even in it anymore. I had some great success in that. That's where I really cut my teeth in, where I learned a lot of things about competitiveness. But you're right. I got invited to kind of like a reunion at race at the World 100 in Jasper, Florida, which turned into a huge race over the years. And I ran at some of the very first ones of that. And they invited me back to like be this honorary grand marshal kind of thing. But I noticed that there's no camaraderie. There's no fellowship. That's the best way to put it. There's no fellowship anymore. Everybody stayed in their pits. There wasn't this running around helping people like it is at RC or even back whenever I was racing go-karts. You're absolutely right. It was missing. It seemed like a lot that happened in stock car kind of morphed its way down to the go-karts. And I hope that doesn't happen in RC. As much as we might kind of bicker among ourselves, you know, we all still help one another.
Kind of to wrap up, what's next for you? You know, you're back in it now, you're announcing. Mm-hmm. So what's next?
Yeah, so I got Florida RC Championships coming up, which is my series here in 2 weeks at Historic Lake Park. Track's been around like 30 plus years. They used to host the Winter Champs for years, the Losi Winter Champs, I think is what it was called, for years. So we're going down there here in 2 weeks to have an event. Let's see, then I'm off for the rest of October. It gets interesting. It gets very interesting. AMS, I got Florida RC Championships again. I got the Carpet Championships. I got Fall Brawl.
I was hoping you were going to say Fall Brawl.
Yeah, a lot going on in November and December. I think I've got 5 weekends or 6 weekends all in a row. It just happened to kind of fall that way this year. I had some rainouts that took place. So it kind of just backed things up a little bit where it was just weekend after weekend. That kind of style of racing is not really what I want to do. It just kind of fell that way with big event after big event after big event after big event. So anyway, that's what I got coming up. Racing 2 weeks, and I get a little bit of a break, and then I think it's 6 weeks in a row.
Well, now our listeners know where to find you if they're looking for you for the rest of the season. I'm probably most looking forward to Fall Brawl. I love that event for one, but for two, just some of the videos that they have been leaking or I've been seeing with their new track, it looks pretty insane. So I'm really excited to get back to the Badlands.
Yeah, they always build a really, really good track. And I, the very first year I went to Fall Brawl was the year that it was really hot. Do you remember when it got up to like 80 degrees?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember
beautiful.
That. Yes, it was awesome. It. And then the very next year, it was cold and wet. Oh my God, everything was wet from the rains. And it was so cold down in the 30s at night. Everybody had heaters and they wasn't working because it was so cold. And then it rained us out on Mains Day. That was the time that Brent Densford was leading his main. It was pouring down rain. He was checking out, and then his car broke, or wheel. No, his wheel came off with like two laps left to go. Yeah, with hardly nothing left to go in a race, and it was out. And it's part of racing, but God, it sucked.
I finished third in that race, so he pretty much gave me a podium. But I have some crazy pictures from that race because, I mean, you're racing in the rain at that point. Let's call it what it is.
Yeah.
But, oh, my gosh, my car, myself, like, I looked like I was racing on that track to how much mud and.
Yeah. Yep. It was exciting to watch. And, you know, as much as it sucked to do, it was some good racing, you know. It was real good, but anyway.
I do feel like I'm a totally different racer than I was even when I finished third in that race. But honestly, I feel like one of the reasons why I did as well as I did in the A main of that race is because when it started to rain and the track started to totally change, they call it a rain line in like actual racing. And I felt like I was able, cause I raced my go-kart in the rain before. And I felt like I was able to apply what I know about go-kart racing, at least as far as how the lines go and where you should be and adjust your corners and that sort of thing in the rain. I felt like I didn't do it as quick as some other people. Like Nick Johnston was in that race too. And I think he finished second. He's, you know, way, way better go-kart, way longer go-kart racer than I am. So I feel like some people adjusted faster than I did. But at that point, we weren't even driving on an RC track. I mean, it was like full-on rain track. But I feel like that's why I did so well at that race, because I had enough experience with rain lines that I was able to apply that and figure out where to find the time. So it was fun, though. It was so much fun.
Wasn't it Christian Payhood that won that race?
He might. Ours was the open class, and he was definitely in the pro class. But I think he did very, very well in the pro class, if not won, if he didn't win.
Yeah, I know Payhood. A lot of people don't realize how good of a racer he is. He is somebody that can wheel a car. Unfortunately, his car usually doesn't stay under him. you know, that's, I hate to say it that way. He's a lot better racer than what his finishes sometimes show. And it doesn't matter whether it be 10 scale, 8 scale or whatever. He can wheel. If he gets the time to wrench properly, or, you know, I don't know if he's out chasing girls or, you know, I don't know what he's doing. There are times his car, like, man, did you remember to put the wheel nuts on or not? You know,
I completely agree. He definitely doesn't have the results that he deserves for how fast he is.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. But there's several people that are like that, you know. He ain't the only one.
So. Yeah. We really appreciate your time, Lance. Yeah. It was so fun having you on the podcast. We appreciate your willingness to extend your voice for this much longer after doing everything that you did for the racers at the Southern Nats. So I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast and extending your voice that much more.
Yeah. Katie, thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it. I hope you and David are doing well. And if I don't see you at AMS or beforehand, it sounds like I'll see you at Fall Brawl.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Lance. We'll talk to you later.